And you've got the coronavirus, this pandemic, just wiping folks out. And you get a kind of Jim Crow version of you vote, you die.
The voice you just heard is Dr. Carol Anderson, the Charles Howard Candler Professor of African American Studies at Emory University and the author of White Rage and One Person, No Vote. She's comparing the hurdles faced by Wisconsin voters as they cast their vote during the presidential primary in the middle of a pandemic in April to those faced by Black voters during the Jim Crow era. America the voiceless. Perez.
And I'm Nikki Rojas, and we're the hosts of America the Voiceless.
We believe all Americans have a voice, but too many Americans face roadblocks when it comes to casting their vote. America the Voiceless looks into the barriers many Americans have to overcome to make sure their voices are heard during the voting process. During this episode of America the Voiceless, Dr. Anderson sat down with Nikki to talk about the history of Black voter suppression. How'd your interview go, Nikki?
It was great. Dr. Anderson wrote the book on Black voter suppression, which has an incredibly long and heartbreaking history. You know, it wasn't until 1868, a full 5 years after the Emancipation Proclamation, that the 14th Amendment was ratified, granting citizenship to everyone born or naturalized in the U.S., including the formerly enslaved.
And the 14th Amendment didn't give them the right to vote. It only gave those who were formerly enslaved citizenship, right? The right to vote came later with the 15th Amendment.
There was this pesky little thing called the 15th Amendment, which came out of the Civil War and was passed during Reconstruction. And it said, the state shall not abridge the right to vote on account of race, color, or previous condition of servitude. So when you have it said that clearly, it's really hard to write a law that says we don't want Black people to vote. So what Mississippi came up with was to say, we will use the societally imposed conditions on African Americans and make those conditions the access to the ballot box.
And one of those societally imposed conditions was the poll tax, which was a Jim Crow law that forced citizens to pay in order to register to vote.
Yeah, in theory, poll taxes were put in place to pay for our democracy. But Dr. Anderson explained just how unfair the poll tax was and how it disproportionately affected Black voters.
We have all of these elections. You got to have people who can count the ballots. You got to have people who take the ballots. And it's just, so if you really believed in democracy, you would be willing to pay a small fee, a poll tax, so that democracy could run smoothly. So part of what you see here is the shifting of the responsibility onto the individual. If you really believed in democracy, you would pay a small fee. And so the fee actually came to about 2 to 6% of the annual family farm income in Mississippi, because the societally imposed condition of poverty, hundreds of years of unpaid labor via slavery, then the Black codes, then sharecropping. So when you say all you have to do is pay a small fee, but you have societally imposed conditions of endemic poverty, that is a massive burden to bear.
I don't think many Americans realize the violent voter suppression Black Americans experience. They were lynched and beaten and threatened and literally run out of their homes. It's mind-blowing to learn about the lengths that white people will go to stop Black voters from voting.
Yeah, and so one of the things that I stressed in White Rage is that as a nation, we're so drawn to looking at the violence and seeing it almost as episodic or as unique that we miss what I call the bureaucratic violence that allows that physical violence to happen, that sustains it, that legitimizes it.
There were plenty of instances where whites resorted to physical and deadly violence to intimidate Black voters before they made it out to the polls, and in some cases, even after they managed to cast their ballots. There's no better example than the Wilmington insurrection of 1898. The only coup d'etat to occur in the U.S., the insurrection saw a mob of white supremacists march on Wilmington City Hall to overthrow the newly elected local government, which included both Black and white lawmakers. These white supremacists succeeded in overthrowing the government and installing several Jim Crow laws, including poll taxes and literacy tests, to disenfranchise Black voters.
Unfortunately, the Wilmington insurrection wasn't the only horrific massacre Black voters had to experience. The Colfax Massacre is one of the worst incidents of racial violence in the U.S. after the Civil War. On Easter Sunday in April 1873 in Colfax, Louisiana, 65 to 153 Black men were killed by a white militia. Nearly 50 years later, in November 1920, on the day of the U.S. presidential election, 56 Black Americans were murdered after they were attacked by a white mob in Ocoee, Florida.
We have whites who are absolutely angry about the outcome of an election or Black people voting, that they, in fact, massacre Black folk. That cannot happen unless there is the state sanction around those massacres that says, you know, it's all right, we understand.
This violence against Black voters who are just trying to exercise their constitutional rights is ongoing for decades after the Reconstruction. It's not until 1965, nearly 100 years after the 15th Amendment was ratified, that the U.S. government passed the Voting Rights Act.
It was more than 100 years ago that Abraham Lincoln, a great president of another party, signed the Emancipation Proclamation. But emancipation is a proclamation and not a fact. A century has passed, more than 100 years, since equality was promised. And yet the Negro is not equal. A century has passed since the day of promise, and the promise is unkept.
That was President Lyndon B. Johnson, who signed the Voting Rights Act of 1965 into law. The law outlawed discriminatory voting practices, like literacy tests, that were used by Southern states after the Civil War. After the U.S. House of Representatives debated the voting rights bill for over a month, it was finally passed by an overwhelming majority vote on July 9th. Johnson signed the bill into law that August with Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. and other civil rights leaders by his side.
Many of the issues of civil rights are very complex and most difficult. But about this, there can and should be no argument. Every American citizen must have an equal right to vote. There is no reason which can excuse the denial of that right. There is no duty which weighs more heavily on us than the duty we have to ensure that right. Yet the harsh fact is that in many places in this country, men and women are kept from voting simply because they are Negroes.
It's been, what, 55 years since the act passed? Nikki, where do we stand now with this, and what's changed since then?
Well, Maria, for the most part, we know that the Voting Rights Act worked. However, in the 2 years before the 2013 Shelby decision by the U.S. Supreme Court, 180 new voter restrictions were established in 41 states, and 27 laws were created in 19 states, almost all of them controlled by the GOP. Dr. Anderson explained to me just how voter suppression is at play today.
In 2013, the U.S. Supreme Court gutted the Voting Rights Act. The Voting Rights Act was put in place to deal with the kind of voter suppression that emerged out of the Mississippi Plan. In 2013, the U.S. Supreme Court said that there's no need really for the preclearance provisions of the Voting Rights Act, which said that states that had a history of discriminating against its citizenry and that had used some of these voter suppression techniques, that they had to be pre-cleared. They had to get the okay from the U.S. Department of Justice before they changed their voting laws. The Voting Rights Act worked. It worked so well that the U.S. Supreme Court gutted it, saying that racism was no longer a factor in American society, not like it was back in the 1960s. 2 hours after that Supreme Court decision went down, Texas implemented a voter ID law that the courts have found to be racially discriminatory. You also saw North Carolina with a series of voter suppression techniques. So let me kind of walk through those because, again, they all sound reasonable. And they're not. Voter ID. So voter ID is based on the lie of massive, rampant voter fraud. The lie that you have all of these people who are donning different baseball caps and going in and voting over and over and over again, stealing elections, using somebody else's identification, that you have people who taking the names of dead people and voting. So you got dead folks voting, you got dogs voting, and it's just this, it's a lie. We know it's a lie.
So since it's a complete lie, how do Republicans think we should combat this so-called voter fraud? How do we get rid of this?
Republicans are big advocates of voter ID laws, which require voters to present a government-issued ID when they want to cast their ballots. In our conversation, Dr. Anderson explained that while voter ID laws can seem reasonable, they're really problematic in practice.
All you have to do is show your ID. And it plays to a middle-class norm that, well, everybody's got an ID, except not all IDs count. In Texas, for instance, Texas's law said you had to have a government-issued photo ID, but your student ID, like from the University of Texas, a state university, does not count, but your gun registration card does. By selecting different types of IDs, you're able to craft your electorate because you know who holds what types of IDs.
Based on Dr. Anderson's research, public housing ID in Alabama was not on the list of accepted government IDs. But this is super problematic because 71% of people living in public housing in the state are Black. That, to me, just feels targeted. It's still a government-issued ID, so it makes you wonder, if the population of government housing was 71% white, would the law change or still even apply?
Alabama said public housing ID is not an acceptable form of a government-issued photo ID. But think about it, does it get more government-issued than public housing? If you eliminate that form of ID, you're able to just cancel out a large part of the electorate.
The issue around voter ID laws is so interesting because it prompts the question as to whether both political parties participate in voter suppression, or if this is something we only see on one side. Dr. Anderson's answer to that question was pretty insightful. Is this something that goes along party lines, or is this something that kind of all political parties are guilty of?
And so one of the things that we have to be really careful of is doing knee-jerk both sides-ism, or both of them do it, because both of them don't do it. The Democratic Party will gerrymander, as will the Republican parties. Party. But what you see is there's a constituency within the Democratic Party that will fight against that. So when New Jersey Democrats tried to do extreme partisan gerrymandering, which is to rig the map so that they would stay in power regardless of the vote, you had constituencies within the Democratic Party just jumping up and down going, oh, not today. You will not. And those New Jersey Democrats backed off. You don't have the same kind of constituency within the Republican Party. So gerrymandering, both do it, but you also have different outcomes because of the way that the parties are constituted demographically. But it's the Republicans. What's driving the Republicans is a demographic apocalypse. So let me do a quick history here. After Lyndon Johnson signed the Civil Rights Act of 64 and then the Voting Rights Act of 65, Southern Democrats looked up and they're like, oh my God, we cannot be in a party that believes that Black people are citizens and that will honor their rights. I mean, where do we go? What do we do? And the Republicans said, come to us. And it's called the Southern Strategy. And so you see the Republicans wooing in the solid Democratic South because in their vision that it would give them the representatives in Congress that would allow them to push forward a conservative agenda. But the Southern Democrats at their very core are white supremacists. That is the key ideology, anti-Blackness. And so when that ideology is then brought into the Republican Party in its pure, uncut form, that virulence of that toxicity began to absolutely transform the Republican Party. It drove the moderates out. It moved the party further and further to the right, so much further to the right, that as America became much more diverse and much more liberal, the party recognized that it could not win an open election because its policies are so repugnant to the majority of Americans. And so they developed, they could go one of two ways. They had what they called the autopsy after the 2012 election that said, look, we got to do better. We've got to modify our policies. We've got to reform. And the answer was no, we're not doing that. Or you could suppress the votes of people who will not vote for you. And that's where they have doubled down.
You know, Obama did a really great job at energizing all these groups of people, like Latinos and Black people and the young and the poor, and that just scares Republicans. And ironically enough, the people that Obama energized enough to vote are exactly the people who are victims of voter suppression. It's one of the sole reasons why we created this podcast in the first place.
You're right. It does scare Republicans, so much so that they go out of their way to create roadblocks for these voters, from purging the voter rolls to enacting voter ID laws. We're seeing this across the country. Dr. Anderson described one such instance in Alabama.
Then what Alabama did, under the guise of being fiscally responsible, Governor Bentley shut down the Department of Motor Vehicles in the Black Belt counties in Alabama, saying this would be a cost-saving measure. But what it did was it put then the other locale for getting an ID out of the reach of people who lived in the Black Belt counties. And the Black Belt counties are those counties that have a sizable, and for some, the majority of the population, are African Americans. So you create an obstacle. You have to have an ID to vote. Then you create an obstacle to the obstacle. Your public housing ID doesn't count. And now you're going to have to go tens and tens and tens of miles to be able to get an ID.
It seems that Republicans can just pick and choose which IDs voters can use to be eligible to vote. It's wild that Republicans aren't really hiding this anymore and are just publicly trying to suppress the vote.
Yeah, they're being way more vocal and way more public about their actions and their intentions. I mean, President Donald Trump only recently, when discussing the coronavirus stimulus package, outright said that expanded voter participation would hurt the Republican Party.
I will tell you this, if you look at before and after, the things they had in there were crazy. They had things, levels of voting that if you ever agreed to it, you'd never have a Republican elected in this country again.
It does scare Republicans, so much so that they go out of their way to create roadblocks for those voters, from purging the voter rolls to enacting voter ID laws. We're seeing this across the country.
Yeah, that's just one too many states that allowed this to happen. Didn't Dr. Anderson say that in theory, cleaning up the voter rolls sounds reasonable, except it's really not.
There's nothing wrong with maintaining our voter rolls, but what we know is that minorities don't vote regularly, poor people don't vote regularly, and young people don't vote regularly. And a lot of that has to do with the ways elections are held, the timing of elections, the ability to get off. If they move the voter polls, then it makes it difficult for you to get there, to go vote. I mean, all of these pieces are in place that continue to make it, you know, remember the Mississippi Plan of 1890, the societally imposed conditions.
So where do we go from here? What did Dr. Anderson say to you on what politicians can do to stop this? And how can voters themselves stop this?
Dr. Anderson had a fairly clear path forward to end voter suppression, but she was pretty adamant that those in power could and would continue to attempt to suppress the will of the people.
So the first thing that has to happen, frankly, is that we have to have politicians in power who believe in democracy and who are consistently thinking through how do we expand access to the ballot box for all of our eligible citizens. So you have states that are opening this up, and it is working. It is working. But you have states that are doing everything in their power to suppress the vote. And what that requires, unfortunately, is that it requires a massive voter turnout in spite of the hurdles to remove the politicians so that there are electoral consequences, ballot box consequences for systematically throttling the basic right to vote for American citizens.
We definitely saw this in Wisconsin, which recently held its primary elections amid a global pandemic. Wisconsin's conservative-led Supreme Court blocked all attempts to extend voting deadlines or lessen absentee ballot requirements. But that didn't stop Wisconsin voters, and it ended up hurting a conservative judge in a big way.
Wisconsin voters will head to the polls tomorrow. That decision after a day of back and forth over Wisconsin's presidential primary. Within just the last hour, we learned the state Supreme Court overruled Governor Tony Evers, saying he cannot postpone the election.
During the Wisconsin primary, Democrat Jill Karofsky ousted Justice Daniel Kelly from his seat. Ironically enough, the conservative judge forced voters to come out and vote during a pandemic, and they ended up voting him out.
Several times, both on Twitter and on TV, President Trump endorsed conservative Justice Daniel Kelly, but it did not seem to be enough to sway voters. Tonight, liberal Justice Judge Jill Karofsky, rather, has won a seat on the Wisconsin Supreme Court. Now, Karofsky's win shifts the balance to a 4-3 conservative majority on the high court. Now, it was the state Supreme Court that ruled that Tuesday's election would go forward. Justices sided with Republicans to keep that election on April 7th. Daniel Kelly recused himself since he was on the ballot.
So right now, what it's going to be is the steel willingness of American citizens to fight for this democracy by just saying, I see your voter suppression. and I raise you one. I will vote you out. Frankly, the people will save us. The people will fight for this democracy.
That's a pretty powerful statement from Dr. Anderson. The people will fight for this democracy.
We've definitely seen that fighting spirit throughout American history. And I just hope that it inspires people to continue to fight for their rights, especially their right to vote.
Thank you for joining us for this episode of America the Voiceless. Tune in next week as we take a look at another form of voter suppression, the lack of voting rights of Americans who've gone through the criminal justice system. A special thank you to our podcasting director, Lysandra Golich, and our podcast producer and engineer, Willis Polk.
This podcast is brought to you by The North Star, an independent media site fully supported by our members on thenorthstar.com. If you're not already a member, we'd love for you to subscribe so you can support our work. You can catch a fresh episode of America the Voiceless every Thursday on Spotify or Apple Music or wherever you listen to podcasts.